Okay, let's go ahead and get started.
Fall break. So what do y'all think of fall break?
Was it nice? Was it kind of like in the wrong place? Was it?
It's good. It's the wrong place.
It's not halfway. It makes no sense.
The week of Thanksgiving would make more sense. That's the week U of O has it.
No.
Yeah, and I think.
What? You don't like that?
I actually think this, like, a week later, so like this week would make more sense.
This week would make more sense? That's
I
definitely.
It is split midterms on the outside, so instead every midterm ended up being before, so that had nothing to do with the break.
It was a break. It was a vacation.
Okay, that's cool. Wait until fourth year. I'm in my fifth year, so I still didn't have anything.
It seems like there. If you put it for the week of Thanksgiving, then your midterms would all be the week afterwards. When you'd come back from that week, then would be all your midterms. So you'd be able to, you know, learn stuff for the first part of the semester, go home, stuff your face, spend the rest of the week studying, and then take tests. Does that sound better? I don't know. I don't know. I'm glad. Actually, last week was really good for me because. So first off, I have not finished grading the midterms. The TAs have done their work. I have not finished mine. I was finishing a grant application, which I'm glad my grant is off as of Friday. So now I can finish the grading, and by this Friday it will be done. Maybe by Wednesday, but I'm not going to promise things until they're done. But definitely by Friday. So I'll give them back to you in a tutorial this Friday. And speaking of which, assignment 3 is up as of this morning. Assignment 3 is based on letter, I might tweak it a little bit, but it's based on the, what do they call it, letter trace? No. Letter paint, yeah. The letter paint code. And I basically have you adding features to it in the assignment. And there's several things that go beyond, significantly beyond what you covered in tutorial. So, you know, and one of the questions is, so it's 40 points with a 10-point bonus, and the 10-point bonus is make the game better. And however you wish to make the game better, you can, and you can document it, but that's a bonus question. Otherwise, you have to do things like make a constantly updating high score, constantly updating high score. You have to add a score to the corner. You have to add a timeout to give them encouragement as they're doing if they're taking too long to do the trace. So, yeah, you have to come up with some motivational phrases to give. Try to make them. Well, if you want to taunt them, it's okay, I guess. But. So the idea is you have to have a timeout that if they take too long to trace a letter, it pops up a little message in the corner saying, "You can do it. Keep going." Yes?
So when is this due?
This is due on the 14th. Right now, that date is potentially a bit flexible. I mean, it's, you know, because basically the only major test now is the... The only major thing right now is the final, of course. There's assignment 3, assignment 4, and the final. That's what's left for this class. So I can be a little flexible on that. But November 14th, that's the, you know, that's the day before tutorial. I know I would prefer for you all to come to tutorial because they're important and things. But so talk to me. If you're finding that too stressful, you need a little extra time, start. You can ask me for an extension. If enough people ask me for extensions, I will forward. I will change the due date to, you know, a little later. Yes?
Yeah, well, you said this last tutorial was a bonus. And some people asked whether the bonus...
The tutorial was not a bonus.
Oh, it wasn't?
No, I asked that, and it was very... Because the idea is if the tutorial was not a bonus, it was just going to be kind of an extra little thing. But this was... The whole point of this tutorial was I basically made a regular tutorial because everyone told me that they needed a tutorial to help with the assignment. And in fact, yeah, that's what is the assignment. So if you did not show up and you thought it was a bonus tutorial, let me know.
Yeah, but so.
But the idea was that, you know, that material is, yeah.
If the tutorials were worth a certain percentage,
No, the bonus I just talked about is for the assignment.
Which assignment? Oh, assignment three. Okay.
Yes. That's what I was just talking about. Was assignment three has a bonus question on it. Because there is an obvious scope for creativity in this to make the game a little more interesting. And if you can think of how to make the game more interesting, please do. And I will give you up to 25% of the assignment as a bonus point marks. How exactly I will count that into your final grade, I haven't decided, but I think that will probably count as straight up bonus marks towards your final grade. So that's kind of the easiest way to do it. So kind of question for the questions and stuff, but that's kind of how. So basically, there's two more assignments, then there's the final. Now, one thing I am concerned about the assignments is, so Annie's finishing up grading assignment two, and she noticed that many people didn't do the coding portions of that assignment, which was like. Was assignment two particularly hard or something like that or anything? I mean, of course, this is a biased sample because you all are the people who are in class, which is about half, probably about less. And of course, you know, I think that probably correlates highly with the people who actually did the coding. But for those of you listening to this on the recording, do the coding. Well, in particular, if you talk about the assignment three, it's all coding. And assignment four will probably have some more abstract questions, but again, it will probably be, you know, it'll be code and maybe, you know, some sort of, you know, code analysis or something. It's just, you know, this is a programming class. If you don't do the part of the assignment that's programming that has big point scores, I mean, how do you expect to actually learn stuff? But, and if there's reasons why you can't do it, then let me know, but otherwise, it's kind of the point. And actually, I kind of think the programming for this class is actually kind of fun, but that's, you know, it's kind of, you know, this the web stuff, I feel like, you know, as opposed to just sort of doing low-level system behaviors like, okay, it printed out something on the screen. Get to make programs that kind of do something. But what I wanted to talk about today is, client-side JavaScript, because I talked about client-side JavaScript at the beginning of the term, I talked a bit about the things, and then I haven't talked about it since. We've got to talk about that now. You've got to understand that now, because the tutorial and everything is basically all client-side. There is a bit of server-side stuff where you're going to integrate the client with the server, but we're now doing mostly the client-side stuff. And hopefully you'll see why I postponed doing the client-side stuff to now. So, we'll talk about client-side JavaScript. So the best way to understand client-side JavaScript. So whenever you think about a programming language, there is the language, and then there's the programming environment. And these two things sometimes are very tightly coupled, and sometimes they're very separate. So for example, if you think about the C programming language, have you read the little thin book on C by the authors of C? Okay, why can't I think of their names right now? Thompson, K&R, Kernighan and Ritchie. There you go. So the Kernighan and Ritchie original book, The C Programming Language. If you have not read this book, it is worth reading. It is a very small book. And it's kind of like you're used to a lot of these programming language books and something like these giant tomes. The C programming language is a book. It's just this tiny little thing. And it just describes what C is. And when you read it, you realize it's a tiny little book because C is a tiny little language. You might be going, what? C is tiny? What are you talking about, C being tiny?
C is probably, out of all the high-level languages, is probably the closest to straight-up assembler. It's, as far as high-level languages go, it's pretty low-level.
It's so low-level, it's often not considered a high-level language at all. People have called it a medium-level language.
And it's part of its advantages, it gives you a lot of low-level hardware access and fairly easy conversion to machine assembler machine code.
So when you talk about, so there's C, the programming language. C is a small language. It's small for lots of reasons, some of which are good, some of which are not. But if you are become a good C programmer, is it enough to just master that little core of C? Not at all. You have to also master the standard libraries. And you look, in fact, at that little book, that the first half of it is the C language, the second half of it is the C standard library, which is all the routines that are supposed to be standard, you know, implemented with every C package. That you, if you write C, you should be able to count on these functions being available, these header files being available. And of course, if you're really going to be a good C programmer, you don't just learn those, but you learn the libraries and stuff for whatever application domains you're working in. So really you think of this language, there's API, which really means functions and objects, depending on the kind of. So the language is the API, and then there are the tools. In the runtime environment. So tools as in dev tools, debugging, and the runtime environment is what's the, so this is what you call, and this is what's there. The runtime environment is the code that is running in the environment that your program exists in, which often provides implicit things that these other things depend upon. So to do well, to understand, when you say to understand programming, or programming language, what you're really talking about is understanding all of these things. If you're talking about a language like C, the runtime environment is in a sense very simple. It's pretty low, to, low level, close to the metal. What you end up learning with the runtime environment in C, classically, is you learn Unix. Because really C was co-designed with Unix, and so when you end up programming C, you end up coding with Unix. And you try doing it in an environment like Windows, you end up having to learn low-level Windows stuff, but it gets a little bit weird because a lot of times things will be kind of Unix-y and then have a little ship or something. So
it's like trying to run something originally meant for Windows on a Mac. You can do it, but they are not really meant to work together.
Okay. Is that door closed?
Yeah,
it does.
If I knock the garbage can out of the way. Want me to?
Okay, stop. C++ and other languages, I mean, if you look at all your languages, it's important to think about what these look like. Now, with web programming, why web programming is a tricky environment to program in is not so much because the programming language is a funny beast. I mean, JavaScript is a bit weird, and I've taught you some higher level concepts in it, but honestly, that's not the really hard part, I don't think. I think the hard part is realizing all of this other stuff, because this is a massive stack when it comes to the web, for multiple reasons. Because, well, first off, it's a client-server architecture. And if you're running a web application, you're having to write stuff on the client and on the server. And those are two different environments. They're not symmetric. Actually, by doing things in Node.js, we're making it more symmetric than it is typically, but they're very different environments in which to run code. But then, in addition to that, you have to just deal with, because of that, you have to deal with all these different APIs and the different parts, you have to deal with the tools, and you have to deal with all the kind of runtime issues, which part of which come from the different environments which the code's run on either side, and the whole fact that it's connected by a network connection. So, to become good at web programming, you have to really have a mental model of all of this stuff. And this other stuff is messier than it is in a classic C, C++, Java, it doesn't matter. It's just more of a mess. Yes?
Part of it's also the lack of standardization. Well, how things communicate over the internet is standardized out of necessity. What at either end is not.
Yeah. Well,
so you don't know what kind of computer your client is running.
Yeah. So when you say client server, so you know, client variation, office. So well, let's make it more concrete. So we're talking about browsers. Browsers, we're talking about server side environments. We're talking about, you know, this is for programming. And which is really, and then we have databases, which we haven't even talked about yet, but you all should hopefully be seeing the need for databases as you're doing your persistent stores in Node and seeing them go away, and you're also seeing the issues of having to have concurrent access. Imagine trying to run this now and have multiple web servers running. It'd be nice if there was a unified data store behind them. That's where databases come in. Now, there's definite variation in browsers. You all see those. There's huge variation in server-side code because as long as they implement the standard API, you can do this. I mean, I could have taught this entire course using PHP. I could have taught it in Java. I could have taught it in Scala or something. I mean, there's just so many different, you know, .NET. There's so many different server-side programming environments. And databases, similarly, there's so many different ways to store data on the server. So we're not going to, I'm going to talk as the course goes on later on about kind of some of the variations in some of these technologies, but this is a mess. But today let's talk about this thing. Because ultimately the browser, we talked about the server, you've kind of got an idea how Node works, you've now written code for it, hopefully you're starting to feel a little more comfortable with it. The browser is a whole other programming environment. As complex, if not more complex, than, say, when you're programming C or C++ or something. And now, you've learned the language. JavaScript is JavaScript is JavaScript. That's actually pretty standardized as a language. So, you know that part. You don't know this. Or this, really. So before you could understand the differences, you have to understand where did this come from? I mean, server-side JavaScript, if you start reading the Node documentation, you see what are the underlying things that Node provides. It provides things like processes. It provides files. It provides a lot of things that look like standard APIs that you've already learned in your other classes when you learn Java or C or whatever. It looks kind of like that. Big deal. But when you get to the web browser, that's not there at all. It's all basically gone. The APIs are all completely different. And so the question comes in, why? If you understand why, the how, I think, is much more approachable. So why can't they just have the same darn APIs in the browser as you do on the server side with JavaScript? Why'd they muck it all up?
Browser really can't count on a lot. It doesn't know what kind of hardware it's running on, what OS that hardware is running.
So there's portability issues. Basically, what you're talking about is that you have to run a lot of different platforms, you have to have different ways.
Yeah, there's several different manufacturers. And it's basically got one requirement. It has to be able to communicate through the internet and display it to the client. And how it goes about that is basically free-for-all.
Okay, that's true, but I wouldn't call it quite the reason I was thinking of. Yes?
Basically, the browser has been around a lot longer than like modern web servers have been around for. Like you were saying at the start of the class, not this class, but like in other classes, websites used to just be HTML and like files that you would read off on the server.
Right. Yeah, server side, the technology has very much changed. It used to be server side, it was just distributing files. and to the client. And now instead of distributing files, it just running a program which generates you know output that goes to the browser. So that historical legacy has been able to change in a very smooth way on the server, but the client is still, in some sense, it's still a browser. So there's the legacy issue is definitely key. It's not quite it.
I think it's more because our two separate different things. The server is like a machine that has some functionality, some functions you can use, and the browser has a lot of different other ones. So you can have the same language talking with the both machines at the same way. We have to do something different.
Okay. So,
I'm going to guess because browser-side JS and server-side JS is kind of like a peer-to-peer connection, not necessarily client-server, because a lot of the work is offloaded on the client as well as server. What they do is different, but they still have to be able to serve and respond.
Right. So I would say to the degree that they're symmetric is actually a thing of saying that the client and server should be the same. So in fact, actually, in modern programming, we do try to make it more uniform, although oftentimes you try to offload computation to the client where possible because, well, there's more of them, so might as well move the cycle. And if you're the server developer, it's not your cycles. So might as well put them off to the browser so you don't have to. Of course, it depends on what browser it's running on. You may have more or less cycles depending on how fast it is at running JavaScript. Now, getting at here is the best way to think of this is what was the first programming language of the web? What was the first programming language of the web? No, it wasn't a programming language. That was the original language of the web for distributing documents was HTML. The first programming language of the web was Java. Java applets. So with Java applets, there was this really nice distinction in the environment. There was a page. So you'd have a page, and then you'd say, in this page where I have my document stuff, I will designate this box as being the box for my applet. In the applet, I would run my Java code. That Java code would be downloaded from the server, it would run in the box, and it could basically be like most other code. The only real difference of this code is that it was running in a sandbox. So one thing we have talked about is this notion of sandbox and what that means. Now, Java was the first one to do this, and then another thing that became popular, of course, is Flash. But same execution model. Which is, you have your page, it's a standard HTML document and stuff, we have a box. In that box is where the Flash applet or the Java applet runs. And the important thing is this distinction, this boundary. It's separate. It's given essentially a window in the page. So it's just like a window on your desktop almost, and it's confined to that. And it can't really access much outside of it. And the only thing normally can access on the network is its home server. So the rise of the modern client-side web programming environment is as much as anything about saying, this sucks. This is not the way to build programs. You might say, wait a second, because if you look at programming a Java applet, there are certain restrictions on what you can do and certain ways in which functionality is limited, but it's otherwise pretty standard. You just have some restrictions in your APIs, but otherwise it's a pretty standard programming environment. It doesn't look really different than something you'd write on the desktop or on the server. I mean, it just depends on, you want to build a GUI, use certain things, you want to do some network programming, there's certain things, just stuff like that. JavaScript just looks weird. JavaScript, web application, just doesn't fit that model. When you start looking at these APIs, it just doesn't look like what you've been using on a standard desktop. And the reason why is because JavaScript came out of, because JavaScript didn't start in a little sandbox and move out. JavaScript started in the page. JavaScript was a programming language that said, I want to make add functionality here. And then people wanted more and more functionality here, and so it could control everything. It wasn't split off in this little world. So that means that it started first being very focused on the page and programmatic manipulation of the page. That was its reason for being. And all the other standard programming type environments came about later. And it's all more, in some sense, a retrofit on top of this. You might go like, it's really ugly. It's really messy. Why did they make all these choices? Why couldn't they just make it like what everything else is? It's because it didn't start that way. And when they did do it that way, it sucked. Because the hard part of doing this is, how do you exist in this environment? How do you exist with this document? Because the web is not just programming. The web is about data. In a sense, it's data first. And the code came later. And the code had to conform to that data. So the complexity of writing client-side JavaScript is you have to interact with that client-side data. You might notice, what was the architecture of the letter paint code? The data was in HTML, was all in the page. Things that, I mean, like all the windows that you're going to put up, all the text that was going to be in them, it was in the HTML. It wasn't in the JavaScript. The JavaScript chose which parts of the page would be manipulated, which div tags would be displayed, and which one would be hidden. But the content was all in the HTML. And see, this goes back to the fundamental thing. The data is first. The code comes to manipulate the data, but the data is primary. In a classic programming language, the code comes first, and the data comes in a secondary fashion. So that's why this is all weird, to a first approximation, is because it's data first, code conforming to the needs of the data, as opposed to code first, and you make the data fit what the code wants. So.
So in other words, it was the first attempt at running it through a new paradigm, and its staying power is simply because it was first, and there's a lot to be said for first adoption.
No, we had a programming languages that were first. We tried to do it the standard way.
It's the first one in the new paradigm working from the
right.
Page.
Yes, that's true. Right. It's the first one working from the data-centric side. Yes, exactly. Because every time they just tried to have a programming language in a box. That would, because you had to do it in a box, because what do you do with all that other stuff? If you make it data-centric, you have to deal with the messiness of the data representation. And programmers were like, no, I want my nice little environment where it does it exactly the way I know how to do it. And they did that. But it couldn't do all the cool things of the web because it couldn't keep up with the flow of data. JavaScript could. And thus, popular. I'm not saying it's the best programming language in all ways, but it's been battle-tested to do this. And so what that means is what's the magic? And this actually part of the design of JavaScript, part of the things that make it weird from a programming language perspective in terms of what you're used to, is exactly what makes it easy to use or best adapted for doing this sort of data manipulation. So when I say that it's data-centric and I say that it's focused on the data, what's the interface between these worlds? I've talked about this before, and you've now had to manipulate it a little bit. So the key thing is the DOM, the document object model. The way JavaScript interfaces with the current web page is that it has a data structure. It has multiple data structures that we refer to as the document object model, meaning it's a model of the current document in the form of objects. It, you know, the one of the key jobs of the browser as it renders the page is it doesn't just draw it on the screen, is it parses it and turns it into JavaScript objects. The document object in particular. And so you can programmatically access anything on the web page via the document object. Or things in the window from the window object. So think about trying to do something like the document object model in another programming language. What are some of the difficulties you'll come up with if you try doing a classic programming language, something like the document object model? I'm not saying you can't do it, of course you can do it, but what makes it kind of eh?
Adding properties, removing them, properties, all that kind of stuff.
Well, what's really different about JavaScript objects versus Java objects? What's the key difference?
In most conventional programming languages, everything needs to be defined and declared when you're writing the code. You can't just create the object and then announce it has some property, yet you've never declared that property before. Any compiler will choke on it and throw up the form of error report.
Exactly. What's going to be the class definition of a standard web document? What are the types? What are the properties? What's it going to look like? I mean, I could write a class definition for my home page, and then you'll have to probably change how it's, I mean, either you make it completely degenerate, so it has like, you know, almost no structure to the object, or you make it have, you know, you put in lots of stuff, but then it's going to have a different class kind of definition for every page. You have to update the classes every time you restructure the page. So the fact that JavaScript lets you create the objects, the properties of the objects, connect the objects, not worry about the types of the data associated with them, is exactly what you want for something that is data-centric. Exactly what you want, where you're going to bring loading in the page, where the, and not only will you, you'll be changing the data structures on the fly. I mean, you know, when I say change the data structure, I mean changing the structure of it, you know, adding in new components in and out and changing the types and other things. This is all easy to do in a language like JavaScript. You can do it in other languages, but normally in other languages we think of the data structures as being much more fixed. That they have a nice regular structure with types associated with everything, and then it's all just, you know, has this nice pattern to it. JavaScript is optimized for unstructured data. It's imposing structure on something that is not very structured. So if you see it from that perspective, you go like, oh my God, how would I manipulate a web page from Java? You just think about the class definition you start creating for something like the document object model and stuff like that. It just gets messy. In JavaScript, it's completely normal. And this is what you often see. If you look at programming languages and you look at how they've evolved over time, it's often kind of say, well, why don't you just use that programming language for this task? I like that programming language. You can't just look at that programming language. You have to look at it in its environment and look at what the types are and what data structures. So like, why doesn't C support garbage collection? Well, you look at what C does, and you look at the accesses to it, you look at the tools, and you look at the APIs and stuff, and you go like, garbage collection doesn't fit. I mean, it's not that you can't have garbage collection in one part of it and have this part deal with it, but as a general thing, it's not part of the worldview of the language, and to try to graft it in, it doesn't fit well. And you can make it work, but you'll be in pain. Now, I'm saying that's the same kind of thing. You know, all programming languages to one level are the same, but you know, in practice, they're specialized for different niches. So whenever anyone says, oh, we need another programming language for the web, for doing client-side programming. And they say, oh, we'll, and then they say, the next sentence, they'll say, oh, we, yeah, but don't worry, we won't do much with the DOM access or something. Yeah, that's all kind of messy. And like, uh-huh, yeah. because that's the hard part. You know, the document, accessing the document and interacting with it is the hard part. If you haven't done the programming language deal with it, it's got to be able to do with that well. Don't talk to me about your programming language unless you figure out how you're going to deal with that nicely. And the kind of language that will deal with that nicely are ones that have more dynamic notions of type and that have more flexible notions of objects. And JavaScript is not the only one of those by any means, but you can divide the world into classes of languages, and certain languages do not fit that description. So we're about at the halfway mark, so I will pause here for a couple of minutes and think about your questions, and we'll continue. Next piece, I want to focus on this little bit here. So going back to Java applets, because Java applets very much informed how JavaScript came to be, which is, how do you solve the problem of mobile code? Now, in a sense, we already have, mobile code is saying, okay, I can have code that moves around the network and runs on different computers. It's like every time you go somewhere and download a program to install on your computer, you could say that's mobile code. But with mobile code, we're normally talking about untrusted. Untrusted mobile code. So that means that in the course of normal operation, I will download code that may mean that, you know, is not from a nice person. It's from someone who may mean me harm or at least is written badly or something. Something that you just don't trust them to run on your computer in an unrestricted fashion. So people, computer scientists have thought a lot about, like, how do I download a program and run it up my computer when I don't trust it? And so the concept for doing this in a safe way is normally thought of as a sandbox. So this would run in a sandbox. Now, when we say sandbox, this is a technical term because, of course, it's evocative of a box for, you know, a little box on a playground for sand where kids can play in it and stuff. And, you know, what's it about? It's really more like Thunderdome. As opposed to sandbox, you need to think of it more like a Thunderdome. It's like, go in and play. Who knows what you're going to do inside of there? But we're all safe outside because it's this big metal mesh that's keeping us all from, you know, you can go after each other with chainsaws and whatever inside the dome, but outside we're safe. Okay? And the Thunderdome analogy, you all know what have heard of Thunderdome, right, Mad Max? No?
Mad Max. You guys have referenced never seen the movie.
Okay. So basically, think of it as a giant dome cage where people go, you know, two people go in, one person comes out. And inside of it, there's all kinds of nasty weapons and things, and, you know, you go after each other. There's a crowd outside that's watching, having fun, but they're outside the metal cage, and so they're perfectly safe. They're not threatened by the chainsaws or anything that's going inside. They can just watch. So really, don't think of this as this nice little friendly place for everyone to play or something. This is something to confine something that is dangerous. So I want to be able to run code inside of the sandbox, get at its functionality, but not have it mess with anything I care about. Now, this is a bit of a tricky problem. How do you run code yet isolate? That it can't talk to other things. So the typical strategy for building a sandbox is you have to restrict access. We restrict access to the environment, which basically means restricted APIs. normally in the process model and operating systems or things you run, when you run code, there's code that does computation and there's code that does I/O. If it's just doing computation, who cares? Adding numbers, 2 plus 2, how's that going to affect anything? It's not. What will affect things is if I do some... Now, this assumes I... Well, first off, I, of course, have to restrict the memory. You can't access all memory on the system. You have to have some environment where you can only see that memory. That's your sandbox. But then, in order to do things, it's going to have to do input-output typically of some kind. So you have to restrict the kind of input-output that is allowed from the sandbox. If you do that, and typically sandboxes live or die based on how well they restrict the APIs, how well they restrict the I/O behavior that it can do. Now, the problem is to have lots of really functional code inside of a sandbox, you have to have rich APIs. But the richer you make the APIs, the more it can escape the sandbox. So I'll tell you, in the modern web browser, the sandbox is not perfect. I mean, the sandbox fails from the perspective of the host machine in that the APIs can have programming flaws such as, you know, buffer overflow type errors, you know, indexing errors in how they access arrays or something that require really obscure pieces of code. Those still every so often come up. So you stick some random JavaScript in your browser and it manages to cause the browser to crash. If something can cause your browser to crash, it's probably generated a memory exception that can probably lead to some sort of security violation. Because you can probably rewrite, if you can cause memory to be corrupted, you can rewrite memory, and thus you can arbitrarily change how the program behaves. So that is, sandboxes can fail that way, but modern sandboxes are pretty hardened. It's pretty hard to escape them in that sense. But the APIs that are given to these sandboxes allow you to do lots of things. And now you can, what can you do from a web app and a browser? You can do full graphics. You can do sound. You can access the microphone. You can access accelerometers sometimes and gyroscope, untouched devices. You can talk to the network. Do all kinds of things in the network. We'll talk about the network restrictions in a bit because it's a funny thing. But in a sense, code that you run in your browser is a threat to everyone except your own machine. It's a threat to the user, it's a threat to other folks in the network, but it's not a threat to the machine it's running on. Is that enough of a sandbox? That's still an open question. This is not a completely settled point. I can tell you what is, I can't quite tell you what should be. So, the sandbox idea started with Java applets. So the Java applet
instead of prison,
because that's pretty much what it sounds like. So I will tell you that in BSD land, they have a term for running highly privileged processes in an isolated environment, and it's called jail. So maybe to get to make it a little more distinct, they may have called it, although I think jail may have came after sandbox.
But I think it's called sandbox because in that box you can go wherever you want. So it's like you're in a playground, you have the sandbox, you have all the sand.
Right. There's in prison kind of implies there's restrictions inside the prison too. You can't do whatever you want inside the prison. Inside your cell you have rules. In a sandbox,
you can be creative.
You can be creative, you can do whatever you want. You can play. But it is kind of give this, the whole point of a sandbox in computer science terms is to restrict malicious behavior. You don't normally think of the evil kids trying to get sand outside the sandbox. The metaphor just breaks. So.
I think part of it is also the idea of impermanence. It can do whatever it wants in the sandbox, but whatever it does in there is easily
erased.
Wiped over.
That's actually very true. You're right. I forgot about that. The idea is that you download these mobile programs, they run inside the sandbox, but then when they leave, you can clean up after them and then it's back the way it was. You clean up the sandbox, put the sandbox in, smooth it out, and it's basically no harm done. Even if they made a big mess, clean up the sandbox and you're good. Assuming you got a tarp outside of it, you dump the sandbox in it. Anyway. But you do have to think about this clean living idea. So operating systems are all modern operating systems are all built on things that look kind of like the sandbox in the sense you run processes that are on isolated memory and stuff like that. But one of the key things in the browser with the sandboxing we want to do there is we want to be able to do it so it all existed inside of a classic OS process. We didn't have, there shouldn't be required any sort of hardware-enforced memory restrictions between the code that's running that's been downloaded and the rest of your browser. So you can go like, okay, hardware-enforced memory protection is a great thing. And in fact, hardware-enforced memory protection is such a great thing that modern browsers try to use it. But the sandboxing here was designed originally so that it didn't have to work with that sort of memory protection. So the first thing is, how are you going to restrict what this code is going to do if you're going to have to eventually run it inside of your address space with everything else? So in principle, that code could access any of your browser code and mess with it, and also the code from any other web, any other windows or tabs. How do you restrict it? So what's special about Java as a programming language versus like C or C++?
There's a lot of hardware functions Java just can't do. There's a lot more you can do in the hardware and memory with C that Java is built so that it cannot do.
So what you're talking about is Java is a safe language.
You can't have sex directly in the memory,
yeah,
like in C.
Safe. What I mean is safe pointers. There's no pointer arithmetic. You can't manipulate, you can't access arbitrary parts of memory. You have references to memory, and you have to go through standard access. Like if you want to index an array, you just have to index in the array, and the compiler knows how big the array is, and then enforces it. Now, but think about this for a second. You've got a problem here in terms of programming. It's one thing to say you have these restrictions at the source code level, but you're not going to download typically source to the browser in a language like Java. Once you take that Java code and you compile it directly to machine code and you download it, even if there was restrictions in how it was supposed to do, if someone just manipulates the binary, you could get around them. Java was designed to say, no, we'll still enforce these restrictions at runtime. And the way you enforce them at runtime is through the JVM, the Java Virtual Machine, and Java bytecodes. Have you all heard of Java bytecodes?
Yep.
I assume you all have programmed in Java, but you might have kind of like ignored this. The fact is, when you compile a Java program, it depends on what compiler you're using. If you're using the typical Sun compilers and stuff, it doesn't. If you're using the GNU compiler collection, you can compile, like GCJ, you can compile Java down to C code, down to object code, stuff that will run directly on the processor. Most Java environments, however, do not compile down that way. They compile down to a bytecode. The bytecode looks like machine code, except it's at a bit of a higher level. It has some higher level primitives, but the big thing Java bytecodes have is type information. It knows what, the classes, it knows about arrays, it knows bounds, it knows whether it's a string or knows whether it's a number. So you can't play the kind of games of turning a number into a pointer and other things. It just, the bytecode doesn't let you do that. And thus you have when you load this code into the sandbox to run, the sandbox has got its own Java virtual machine and it has a bytecode verifier.
It will take that bytecode, go through the bytecode, and make sure it follows a whole set of rules to make sure it is consistent and well, the rules being that it should enforce isolation. You're saying that these are the rules for playing in the sandbox, and once you go through the verifier, you know that it is following the rules for staying in the sandbox. And as a result, that bytecoded code can then be converted on the client into machine code at runtime as needed to make it run fast. So Java can run very fast. There's a bit of a just-in-time compilation overhead, but it can translate the frequently reused parts into machine code and have that run very quickly. The overhead mainly then comes in memory for storing the different versions and stuff. And the overhead. Yes?
Also, the virtual machine itself, it's not running. Java is all. The Java bytecode is machine code for a theoretical machine.
Yes.
Has certain
properties. Yes.
Yeah, they define how the machine works. And all the bytecode works for that machine, and then the virtual machine on your computer translates that into how your hardware should use that.
Yeah, but a key thing, but what I'm saying is that bytecode, I mean, this is in general, when you hear a virtual machine, you think of this as an app, a machine, a computational device that is defined abstractly and is not instantiated in actual hardware. That's, whenever we talk about virtual machines, that's what computer scientists are talking about. The Java virtual machine is specially designed to enable mobile code. Because the bytecode, unlike a lot of other bytecodes, has a lot of information that's provided by the compiler to make sure it's following certain properties. And so you kind of do a little proofs of saying, yes, this is how the code is supposed to execute. So if you look at the design of Java, you go through it, there's a whole bunch of features in Java that are all about making it safe. Now, what I find really funny about this is because the modern niche for Java is actually server-side. And on the server, you typically trust all your components. So most of this verification stuff and all these checking things is actually useless. It's pretty much, I can see some environments where this might be useful, but mostly the security infrastructure was created for protecting client-side code. So in fact, what you have on the server side, they have other security protections, which is this very complex access control model, which I don't think anyone uses competently. But all this Java bytecode restriction and stuff was all created to make Java applets work well from a security standpoint. Now, of course, what was the problem with Java? It didn't have access to the document object model. So you wanted to make a more data-centric application, you basically had to implement a browser inside of your Java application. And go like, well, that's dumb. I have a web browser. It's got all these cool things for manipulating, displaying data and stuff. Why can I use that? Why do I have to create an entire new interface and everything manipulation in my code? Because you can't access that. Hence, that's why Java applets were never that good for most things. So when they decided that they wanted to add programming capabilities to HTML, remember, HTML was first designed, what does HTML stand for?
Hypertext Markup
Language. It was a language for creating documents. When they wanted to start programming it, they were thinking about rich.
Documents.
I don't understand why making, some little icon, some little thing bounce on the page or something like that makes it rich. Like luxurious or something? Of course, rich documents end up having little animated things as opposed to, say, good typography. That, I would say, actually is kind of a nice luxury feature of good document, preparation. But animation? Okay, but that's the term. Rich documents, which means interactive. Because people started, on the server side, started turning web pages into the front-end interface for a complex application on the server. So they want to implement a full user interface. How are you going to implement this if it's just static pages? Where, yes, you can click on a link, and it goes to the server, and it brings into you a new page. Every time you make one single change, I mean, it's just not very good. Well, so that lag. So what's the problem with doing a round trip to the server to update the screen on every user interface interaction? Why, you know, we mentioned lag. What do we mean by lag? Is it that the servers are slow?
It's the distance that it takes.
Right. We're fighting the speed of light. We're finding the speed of light, and we're finding the round, and we're finding networking infrastructure. It takes tens to hundreds of milliseconds to send data to the server. It takes to send one byte to the server and send that one byte back. Instead of sending one byte back, you might say, "Wait, our networks are all really fast. We've got gigabit connections and stuff like that." And
that's bandwidth.
So it's byte number one. So when we talk about latency, we're talking about one byte here. It's the whole, it's a round trip. It's an inescapable part of networking that you're going to have relatively high latency. You can optimize this down to some degree, but it's going to be there with every round trip. And in the nature of a wide area network, you cannot, in general, get this to be a consistently small value. So if this round trip is tied directly to your user interface, if that's the fastest thing in which you can update the interface, you're screwed. You're not going to be happy at all. So what we have to do is we still have to talk to the server, but user interaction has to happen faster. That's what JavaScript was designed for, was to do those interactions with the user. And the kind of interactions were very simple things. Things like form validation, drop-down menus, just little interface widgets. And originally they were really ugly, and now they've gotten much prettier, but that was the idea, is that you were just implementing kind of standard GUI type elements inside of your document. And to do those, what sort of programming environment do you want? What sort of operations do you want? If I just want to say build a simple thing for drawing a menu, what do I need to be able to do? So to draw the menu, I just need some way to do, that means draw text and lines on demand, undo. So you want to be able to pop up the menu, and maybe flash, invert colors. So the classic menu would draw a little menu on the screen. When you click on the file menu, it will draw this little box, and then menu items will be inverted in color as you select them. As you move over, it'll move over, and then you want. There. So the drawing wise, pretty simple. You extend you can implement kind of custom things, but if you make your document representation language rich enough, you can make it so that that's all data operations. You're just having to manipulate the document object model so that there's now all of a sudden this another little presentation of data in one part of it. But what else do you need?
you're going to have to be able to tell where the meta is. If you're going to be modifying it just on Metasover, you need meta's input access.
Yep. You need input events. Two things you need for doing GUI is you need to be able to draw stuff, and you need to be able to find out, get user input, so you know when to draw stuff. You have to know when the mouse is doing typically, or the keyboard, or if you're talking on a touch device, you need to know touch events, which are kind of a little different from mouse events in modern systems, but otherwise rather similar. So the whole model of programming JavaScript in the browser was to facilitate two things. One is manipulate the DOM to be able to draw things and get interface, or get interface events. So it's DOM manipulation. And event handling. That's what JavaScript's built around. In the client side, that's what the APIs are oriented towards. It's not oriented towards, let me talk to a file, let me orient a socket, open a socket. Now, modern JavaScript is starting to have some of these features, but this is the core use case. This is what JavaScript in the browser is optimized for, is for doing these things. I want to manipulate the DOM, and I want to find out what the user's doing. The way JavaScript has evolved over time is in the power that you can get from the DOM manipulations and the power that you can get from the event handlers. Because originally, JavaScript was designed so that the only event handlers that JavaScript code could only run in response to an event handler. You would specify an event handler, and then you said, this is the code you run for the event handler. There was no code that was running always in the background. Because it's a document. Why do you have to have code running all the time in the background for a document? I just need to have code running when something happens. And you might say, I want some code to run when I first load the page. So they would have events like onload. But notice, it's all an event. Everything in client side, you run your code runs in response to an event. And you just, and in the course of your document, in the course of your HTML, when you add JavaScript to it, it's all with reference to saying, okay, what event handler am I going to put this going to be hooked to? Because if you don't have it associated with some event handler, the code's not going to run. Because by default, there is no JavaScript running in a web document. So over time, originally this was saying, it was on load and then UI events. Roughly speaking. Now, of course, what's the limitation of this as a user interface paradigm? What if you want something background to happen? What if you want something to constantly check something in the background, say, update the display, maybe allow the server to push something to it? How do you do this? That's not there. So the way you do it is you have to create a new event. And what would that event look like? I mean, you'd want to have events for when stuff comes off the network. I think original JavaScript actually did. I'm not sure if it had timers. So a timer says the event is so much time has gone by. I'm pretty sure original JavaScript did not have timers, but modern JavaScript, you can set timers for periodically doing things. So yeah, I think the old timers, what you could do is you could set a timer to cause the page to do a refresh. So the entire page would be reloaded so often. But that, of course, is a bit of overkill. So how do you think JavaScript got an API for doing background processing? For having an event that allowed for background talking with a server. So you can say when the server has data, retrieve it. Or pushing data to the server in the background. Where do you think, who do we have to thank for JavaScript having that capability? Because it wasn't there at the beginning. Microsoft. Have you ever heard of this? It turns out that Microsoft, specifically the Outlook team, is the one we have to give credit for background processing in web applications and thus making, you know, modern GUI type Gmail and applications possible. They're the ones who did it first and implemented by extending the browser. They extended it with an ActiveX control. So I don't know if you all remember, ActiveX is the standard for Microsoft browsers to basically add object code to the browser. It's becoming less and less supported. I think modern Microsoft browsers don't even support ActiveX anymore. Certainly the non-desktop variety, the Metro ones, definitely don't support it. But it was a way of adding functionality to the browser, extending the program. And so they added an ActiveX control that implemented the method XML HTTP request. We will be talking about this much more, because actually one of the focuses I want to do in the client is talking about how you do the background processing, which is referred to as AJAX. But this, we don't have time, definitely don't have time to cover all that right now. But what the Outlook group said was, we want to make Outlook web access. So Outlook is their major mail client. They wanted the web version of that not to suck. And so how are they going to make Outlook web access work well? They said, well, we can't just update the list of mail and do things just when the user clicks on something. It should be happening all the time in the background. It should be able to update. So we'll add an ActiveX control that can do this in the background. And that will enhance the functionality by adding this XML HTTP request. And folks at Mozilla saw this and thought, wow, what a great idea. We'll implement that natively. Other folks implemented it. And then Google came along and said, wow, we can really use that. And they started making things like Google Maps and Gmail and things with all these kind of factors. But it's all thanks to this. So this model of programming originally was very restricted, but you can see you can do a lot with this. You just have to make sure you enhance the categories. So to get background processing, we had to have another event handler class. It's basically what XML HTTP request gives you. New events on which to associate JavaScript code running. The main browser runs the whole event loop. It decides when things happen. It generates the events, and your code just hooks into these little places that it gives you. The DOM manipulation has fundamentally been enhanced by the development of CSS, cascading style sheets. Original HTML had no style sheets. And they said, well, you mixed in the data with the way it was presented. So you'd say things like, this is bold, this is italic, you'd specify it, and then CSS came along and said, no, what you're really supposed to do with the data is do semantic markup. You're supposed to say what this is, because people had started putting things like fonts and sizes and stuff directly in line in HTML through browser-specific extensions and stuff, and cascading style sheets is a standard for saying, no, don't do that. Specify the semantics in your main web page, specify the styling through this other language, which we will define called CSS, and that will let you describe whatever you want on the screen, arbitrarily, nice GUI-type graphics. And you can make it active, of course, by associating JavaScript with those. So in this class, we're not going to talk much about CSS. If you've done a little bit of manipulation with CSS, it's a very simple kind of language. Basically, it's just saying you specify a class, and then you have properties. Say, for this class, here are these properties, here are the values. You can look at the CSS syntax there, and it's very CSS gets very complex, and it's exact semantics, and how it interacts, and it's got this whole cascading thing, which means you can inherit, you can specify this is the higher level class, and then you can specialize it with another subclass. It's very object-like. It's very powerful. But to really fully appreciate it, you need to be a graphic designer. I'm not a graphic designer. I can kind of understand some of the technical things and stuff, but the beautiful thing about the modern web is you don't have to be good at that stuff in order to make something look reasonable. Because libraries. So, well, actually, I was going to put this into... It turns out I found this letter demo, and this letter demo doesn't actually use... It has its own hand-coded CSS, which is okay. The thing I normally would have used is something called Bootstrap. But I didn't find a nice, simple application. I mean, this application was just so simple. It was just like, okay, well, let's just hack on that. But for the last assignment, definitely, and so the tutorials will play more of the Bootstrap, which you've seen a little bit of. But that's a nice little library for doing GUI stuff. And it just does stuff that looks pretty without you having to think about it. It has its own way of doing CSS. It has JavaScript for manipulating the CSS as appropriate as the screen size changes. So starting on Wednesday, what we're going to talk about now is some of this JavaScript that's running in the page. This thing like XML HTTP requests and how we set up these events and stuff and that basic architecture and think about that event loop and how does that interact with the event loop on the node side. And then on Friday, you'll have a tutorial where you'll play with this because I want you to do this stuff in the assignment and so I might as well have you do the tutorial first. Okay?